I want to introduce our afternoon panel. The theme is growing up Jewish or living a Jewish life in the upstate. And we have four natives of this region, one adopted daughter, I guess I would say, Marcia, but she's been here a good long while. And I'm going to ask a range of questions, but ask the panelists also to feel free to diverge, go off onto your own, whatever, speak from your own experience in your own hearts. We have one microphone, which is in the middle, which it's a mobile, and we can pass it around. Fred Leffert from Greenville. Sam Drazen, originally from Anderson, now in Atlanta, or near Atlanta. And Marcia Polyakov, her son Gary Polyakov, both living in Greenville.
Spartanburg,
excuse me. We tried to get a little regional range here and see, really try to understand what the challenges are and the benefits of living in what really are small communities of Jewish people here in the upstate. So I was going to start with Gary, because I know you're involved in family genealogy and putting together the Polyakov side of your family. Would you describe where your mother and father's families came from? What did they do in the old country? When and why did they leave? And how did they get to the South Carolina upcountry?
Sure, I'd be delighted to. Let me start by talking about my great-grandfather, Rabbi Abraham Polyakov, who came to the South in the 1890s, came from Belarus, where all the Polyakovs seem to have come from, and was in the North and was told that there were plenty of rabbis in the North, but the South needed some. So he went to Atlanta, where he found that Atlanta already had rabbis, and eventually made his way to Augusta, Georgia, and became the first rabbi in Augusta in the 1890s, and of course strictly Orthodox at the time, and the first shul in that area was started at the time. And so other Polyakovs drifted to South Carolina, I think, in his wake. My grandfather, Sam Polyakov, Shlemy, was drafted in the Russian Army at age 15. This was in 1902. And a quick diversion on how that occurred. He had an older brother with lockjaw who was on the Russian Army draft list. And his older brother was pretty frail. In Russia those days, what they would do for lockjaw is they would actually break out your front teeth so you could eat applesauce and soup. And so when the Russian Army came by to draft his brother, they saw how frail he was, but my grandfather was 6 feet tall and robust at age 15, so they said, fine, we'll take you instead. And they did, and shortly after being drafted, he received a small inheritance, made his way to the United States, and came south to South Carolina, and one by one helped bring over all of his siblings. That's how we ended up in the South. My mother's family is from Lithuania and Ukraine. Her dad was born in Lithuania, and her mother's family is all from Ukraine area, owned a coach factory in Ukraine. And they were basically came to Baltimore and grew up in the Baltimore area, and then mom married dad, and they've been here since 1949. So I guess that's the skinny on it. And Polyakovs, actually the front table is lousy with Polyakovs today. It's kind of overloaded.
The Polyakovs proliferated. Mr. Drazen, same. Some of these people I feel I know very well because we've been emailing for months, but this is actually our first time meeting, I believe. Would you talk about what relationships from your childhood you remember most vividly, memories that are both pleasant or unpleasant that stand out?
Well, first of all, I want to thank Gary for telling me how our family got to the South. I've always wondered that. relationships in my childhood mostly were from school. And I remember one time, at that time they had devotions in school, and we would be called to the front to read part of the Bible or lead a prayer. And I was called on to come up and read from the Bible. and I hesitated, and another fellow in the class who wasn't Jewish said, he doesn't believe in that. And the teacher said, well, he can do it anyway. So I came up and did it, and if I'd gone home and told my mother about it, prayer would have been outlawed in the schools long before Kennedy came along. let's see. That's, you know, we had a good childhood. We were a close family, and I don't really remember much unpleasant stuff. We would get together on, always eat dinner together. On Shabbat, we would have a Shabbat dinner. Dad would do the Kiddush. And we had a close life.
What can you talk about any people, either household help or, you know, folks from the larger community who you were involved with in your family?
We had a maid who worked for us, and Dad was a leader in the congregation here. He would he and Joe Fleischman ran the Sunday school, and Dad would lead the services on the holidays and on Shabbat. We only had services on Friday evening, and he and another person, he'd do the Hebrew, another person would do the English. We mostly got along with all our friends here, Jewish and non-Jewish. So some of them would call us dirty Jews. We still played with them. that's about it. Okay. Oh, and another thing is we had the Sunday school here, but then when we got older, we went to Greenville, and we became involved in the USY and ACA, and we made some friends in Greenville too.
I just want to ask you one specific question, because in the family history that you and your siblings helped us prepare for the newsletter, you described the opening day of your family store. I know you were, what, six years old at the time?
Probably around six. We had just moved back from Spartanburg. And there's a picture in the journal that shows a crowd in the store. And they were having a raffle. And the name of the store was Drayson's. And they passed out boxes of raisins. They had put a D on the front. and my daughter Rebecca told me that was probably the first promotional product.
Fred, do you have anything to add on that, to this? Your early memories, what you remember growing up as a child?
Well, it was a relatively small Jewish community. We were kind of invisible, almost, really, to most non-Jews. In fact, I remember one of the benefits of going to school in Greenville before all the Supreme Court stuff was you got a great Christian education. Every morning, elementary school, you know, we would get up, we'd say the Pledge of the Flag, and then we would all recite the Lord's Prayer. And then it was really theologically, as you could certainly say. And then we would the teacher would read us a few verses from the Bible, and depending on how much into it she was, we might get a little sermonette. And as far as our teachers were concerned, you know, they were doing their job. They wouldn't be doing their job if they didn't do that, because the reason you went to school in Greenville is to become a Christian gentleman, you know, when you grew up. It never really bothered me. Actually, if anything, it made me feel more Jewish. And it was really a free Christian education I wouldn't have gotten otherwise.
What about, Fred, in your household, your parents, siblings, household help? Mm-hmm. Or do any relationships stand out in your mind?
Well, we actually, as far as help was concerned, we only had a maid one day a week. And the day before the maid came was a horrible day, because my mother had to clean the whole house from top to bottom. Because God forbid this maid would come in the house and see if, you know, there's any dirt there. I'm not sure. I mean, the maid ended up doing a little bit of ironing for a couple of hours, and that's all there was for her to do. It's odd, actually, relations, though, of course, the maids were always black in those days, and relations between Jews and blacks were kind of interesting, but particularly when we got into the 60s and the Civil Rights Movement started, and that many Jews were really kind of torn because they were, of course, very sympathetic with the Civil Rights Movement, and also very afraid of standing up and doing anything about it, and, you know, given the overall community. So there was a little bit of tension that way.
School teachers? Any individual teacher who made a mark?
Actually, not. not in elementary or high school. Later on, but not then.
All right. I'm going to jump to Marcia, and I'm sure most of you are aware. Marcia has published a history of Spartanburg, the Jewish community of Spartanburg. So this is a little bit more of a historical question. Could you tell us about any pioneers, what I would call pioneers, that of note in any of the three upstate towns?
I have to tell you that Matthew Polakoff was a pioneer. Can you all hear me? Okay.
Bring that closer to you. Bring that closer to you.
Okay. Matthew was the first, as far as I know, environmentalist in Spartanburg. He was determined to have the mills clean up their poisons and their dyes that they put out, their chemicals. And he was very adamant about having them do that. Well, the newspaper didn't take him seriously on that. But actually, I think he did. He did pass some legislation that did require them to not put their chemicals in the streams. Actually, Matthew had these ideas, these very progressive ideas about the environment, 10 years at least before Rachel Carson published her book in 1960. So he was a pioneer in that regard. And Matthew also was the only, at his time, was the only Jewish attorney in Spartanburg. So, and that went on for many years. So I can call Matthew definitely a pioneer. And then we had other pioneers too. We had Holocaust survivors. Schondor Tesler had the first integrated mill on Kings Mountain, and this was completely a new thing in that area. He employed black people as well as white people, and it was very unusual, but it was a beginning.
Yeah, my father Matthew served 7 terms in the legislature during the 40s and 50s, and despite being very Jewish and widely known to be Jewish, was always successful. He at one time held the highest percentage of votes attained, was the youngest member of the legislature when he first went in, and there was the big issues in those days were mill workers versus mill owners, and he was a champion of the mill workers and made him very, very popular.
Mm-hmm. Marcia, were there not also some pioneering women in medicine?
Yes, indeed. The first woman physician to graduate from the medical college in South Carolina was Rosa Gant, and she graduated circa 1902 and came to Spartanburg and was the first physician, first Jewish physician in Spartanburg. And she was also the president of Sisterhood for a great many years. And she was innovative in a very special way. Prior to Rosa Gant coming to Spartanburg, there was no burial place for Jews in Spartanburg. So anytime there was a Jewish funeral, they had to go to Columbia or Augusta or some other area, Greenville. But Rosa Gant negotiated to have the first section of a Jewish cemetery in Spartanburg. And that was in 1924. Since then, we have another one, but she was a pioneer in that regard.
Any other candidates from anybody else for pioneers?
Yeah, Rose Polakoff was one of the first, not the first graduate, but one of the first female Jewish graduates from the medical college in South Carolina.
Mm-hmm. We probably should mention Jack Bloomer recently passed away. When Jack opened his law practice in Greenville, he was the very first Jewish professional of any kind in Greenville. And also, of course, I think there's anybody who should be named is Max Heller, who I think has been more of a pioneer than anyone else in the state in so many ways.
And by the way, we can keep that question kind of in the back of minds, and when we go to question and answers from the audience, if anybody else, I know there are more, nothing's coming leaping to my mind right now, but let's just keep that in mind. Can I ask each of you to talk a little bit about what businesses, basically, your families, what occupations your families have held, and maybe we'll start with Mr. Drazen.
Well, my mom and dad had a jewelry store here. When we first came here, they were working with my uncle Herman Polikoff in his pawn shop. And then we moved to Spartanburg, and they had a jewelry store in Spartanburg. And then that failed, so they came back to Anderson and opened up a jewelry store here. And then later, Barry and David came into the business, and before that, they took in musical instruments too, so it was called a musical jewelry store. Barry and David eventually got rid of all the jewelry, and now they're just in the band instrument business.
Mr.
I can use some help from y'all if you want to.
But in your generation, Sam, you've all diversified. Let's put it that way. You've done a wide range of.
Yeah, we've gone different ways. Like. David got out of the business, became a medical technologist, is that right?
That's right.
And I'm a pharmacist. Bruce Barry's in the store. My sister Bernice was a teacher. Judy's a teacher. And so we went into different routes.
Mm-hmm. Fred, what about in your family? Has there been a generational shift?
Very definitely. My father, the reason I ended up growing up in Greenville, my father came down here in 1928 from New York because one of his cousins started a shirt making factory, the Piedmont Shirt Company. And in those days, basically, there were only two things Jews did in Greenville. Either you had a retail store on Main Street or you were in the textile and apparel business. No one followed in their parents' footsteps, though. Today, there's only one retail merchant in Greenville. That's Jeff Zaglin. He has an Army-Navy store in Main Street. There are no other Jewish retail merchants. And the apparel and textile industry is pretty much dead. I mean, that's something you couldn't go into if you wanted to anymore in Greenville. So there definitely has been a generational break that way. The Jewish community in Greenville now really is mainly professional.
Would you take a stab at what percentage of that community is our recent arrivals, and what percent or have been here, say, more than a generation?
The majority would be recent arrivals. One of the unfortunate things about Greenville is that the kids don't tend to come back. I'm one of the rare exceptions, and Jeff Zaglin is probably the other. I really can't think of anybody else, you know, who grew up in Greenville and then came back to it later on.
Why?
It's a good question because Greenville's changed so much. It was a horrible place when I was growing up in it. When I got out of Greenville High in 1958, and I swore it's the last place in the world I would ever come back to. And then as the years passed, in the 1970s particularly, largely because of Max Heller and what he did in Greenville, the city began to be transformed. I mean, there were things to do there. There was a performing arts center. There were decent restaurants. There was a more diverse population. And I visited there periodically, coming back to see my parents during the 70s, and realized it wasn't the Greenville that I grew up in anymore. And so in 1980, I decided to move back there.
What was it you hated the most?
It was just boring. Nothing else. There was absolutely nothing to do there.
Let's see, Marcia, what are the variety of professions? I know you've got a lot of lawyers now.
Yes.
But where did the family, you know, what sort of the trajectory of occupations?
Well, my father-in-law was a typical Jewish merchant. He started as a peddler and finally had a business, a store, and then all of his sons that reached maturity became attorneys, and that was how our family changed from being merchants into professionals. There was Bernard and Manning and my husband Matthew, and all three of them practiced together at one time, and then they separated. Manning went to Aiken, right, and had practice there. And my two sons followed in their father's footsteps and have practices in Spartanburg. So we have a great many attorneys in our family and other branches as well.
Gary, why do you think, what do you think the attraction of the law is to the Polyakovs? It's not just your immediate family, there are some others in the room.
I think we figured that there are now five practicing Polyakovs in South Carolina, with Ed and Ed's son Eli and Eli's wife, and my brother and I. But I think it's a typical kind of story that the first half of the 20th century, that most Jews were merchants. Dry goods stores, retail stores, and then tried to educate their children. And my dad told me that as a boy, he wandered into a courtroom and it fascinated him, and that's where he wanted to go. His older brother Bernard was an FBI agent in the 1930s, went into Marine Corps during World War II, but then their younger brother Manning became an attorney as well. And they all, like Mom said, practiced together in the early 50s for a period of time.
Mm-hmm. I gather, I don't want to be the leading the witnesses here, but I gather that your father had a passion for social justice.
Yeah, he did. He was very liberal. In those days, everybody was a Democrat. Whether you were liberal or conservative or in between, all local offices were held by Democrats in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, at least until the 60s. But he was on the very progressive side of things, but again, was always highly popular in Spartanburg, despite being Jewish, which never seemed to be a handicap. In fact, there was one of his old funny stories was whenever he campaigned, he would look for any gathering of people or cars and would try to go up to it. He was a hard campaigner and did it year long. And one night, late at night, he saw a gathering way out in the country and went up to it. It turned out to be a Ku Klux Klan gathering. The speaker, Dad's hair had a slight red tint at the time, and the speaker was railing about this red-haired Jew that you've elected to the legislature. Dad came up to the rear, and everybody was honking their horns and shaking his hand and disrupted the whole thing. Everybody was fine with him knowing he was Jewish.
It didn't hurt a bit to be Jewish in Spartanburg at that time. Apparently in Greenville it didn't either, because Max Heller was able to achieve a lot. He became mayor and he was extremely popular. But I think Spartanburg was much more gracious as far as Jews were concerned than most of the other areas.
But we didn't all become lawyers.
Well, coming back down to this end of the table, this may sound like an odd question, but could you talk about how Jewish was your family, a typical Sabbath or a holiday celebration in your parents' mm-hmm. home, and what kind of Jewish education you received?
Well, my father was born in a little village on the Russian-Polish border, and when he was about 8 years old, he was sent away to yeshiva and spent 4 years studying Talmud. Then when he was 12 years old, the family came to America, to New York, where as a teenager, he became an atheist and a socialist. but he never really lost his love for Jewish learning. That's the one thing that you always keep if you have a yeshiva background. And so the house was always full of Jewish books, and there was always Jewish discussion going on, even if he didn't care about going to services and didn't believe in any, you know, in any of that. My mother's father, my mother was born in Minsk, and her father was also a scholar. In fact, he was appalled that she married my father, knowing he was an unbeliever. He was what in Yiddish you call an apikeres, which means, you know, he wasn't nearly pious or observant enough for her. And they spoke Yiddish at home, so I grew up in a Yiddish-speaking home. And even though formally, in a sense, they weren't observant Jews, it was a very, very intensely Jewish atmosphere.
Did you go to Heder? Did you learn any?
I went to Hebrew school, but, you know, typically, and unfortunately, most kids don't really learn very much in Hebrew school. You know, it's, I think, one area, Greenville, and probably most cities in South Carolina really fail at is giving kids a decent Jewish education. So most of the Jewish education I really got from my father more than anything I got in Hebrew school.
Has this been something that you've wanted to pass down? I mean, did it become a value of your own family?
It is, yeah. I think, again, that I absorbed that from my father. That was really his influence. To him, Judaism was more of an intellectual thing than it was a theological thing.
Sam, you want
to? My grandparents came from Russia. I don't know much about my father's family. My father grew up Orthodox. My mother grew up Orthodox, and they instilled in us good religious practices. We were the only family in Anderson that kept kosher. They would have to get their kosher meat from Charlotte or Atlanta, and if anybody came through who needed a kosher meal, they were directed to our house. We had good education at home and here at Sunday school, but we didn't, like Fred said, we didn't learn much Hebrew. We went to Greenville and had Hebrew classes at the shul, Rabbi Barnese, and but they always instilled in us a pride in our religion, and we did the same to our children. I was in the Air Force for 20 years, and we kept kosher every place we went. Even in Japan, we were able to buy kosher meat through the commissary. Every base I was at, I was the lay leader. And in Japan, we had one rabbi who was a Navy rabbi who would go around the country and to the different bases and put on programs. And when we retired from Wichita Falls, we had a rabbi, a retired rabbi who was there, ran the Sunday school. And then when he left, Carol took it over. And we had about maybe 5 or 6 children there. But when we left, we had 2 doctors offer us free medical care if we would stay. But we had family back here we wanted to come to. But all of us married within the faith, and our kids did too.
I think that's rather remarkable.
About Jewish education. We had wonderful Jewish education in Hebrew education, I should say, in Spartanburg. We still do. Rabbi Stauber came in 1955, and he was trained as Orthodox, but he wanted to accommodate the people, so he actually served as a conservative rabbi. But he had one request that he really wanted a whole lot, and that was to have all of the pre-bar mitzvah boys attend Saturday morning services. He was our rabbi for 30 years. and he was a wonderful teacher. Now, the boys who, well, they weren't just boys, they were boys and girls, born bar mitzvahs, who attended the services. And the rabbi would not drive a car on the Sabbaths. So the parents would drop the children off at the rabbi's house, and they would all walk to the synagogue. It was about a 10-minute walk. And then after services, they would return to the synagogue, I mean to the rabbi's house, and the rabbi's wife would give them snacks of chopped liver on crackers. But chopped liver is a cultivated taste, and the little boys didn't really go for it. And I know two in particular would do a little trickery. They would bury the chopped liver crackers under the shrubbery on the and this happened week after week. And then finally, it became autumn, and the rabbi said he was going to rake the lawn. The boys were almost out of their minds. They were extremely worried that they might get found out. So after a week, they returned to the rabbi's house, and nothing was said. And they looked under the shrubbery, and it was perfectly clean. So apparently the chipmunks had taken it.
Saved by the chipmunks. I'd like to get a sense of how organized religion has changed during your lifetimes, what it was like going to synagogue as a child, and how the membership has changed, how the rabbinate has changed, how the role of women and children perhaps have changed. We can start again with you, Fred.
Well, actually, when I was a child, we had the old synagogue on Town Street in Greenville in those days. There was no Saturday morning service because everybody, again, was a merchant who had to open their store up Saturday morning. It was a huge attendance. We get 50 or 60 people there every Friday night. But not for religious reasons. They weren't really all that religious. It was just basically there was nothing to do in Greenville on a Friday night. There were no decent restaurants. The little theater was there, but really nothing else. And basically in those days, most Jews didn't have a lot of non-Jewish friends. The Jewish community was very tight, very insular, and socialized with each other, essentially. And so what you had every Friday night was really amounted to an ethnic solidarity rally, you know, more than a religious service. It's changed. Beth Israel now, the conservative congregation, now has a Saturday morning service. If anything, though, probably I'd say Judaism is much weaker in Greenville than it was back then. There are two congregations in Greenville, Beth Israel and the Temple of Israel. Between them, they probably have about 300 families between the two congregations. That's about what they had 10 years ago and 30 years ago and 50 years ago. So there really has been no growth in the congregations taken together, even though there's been an enormous increase in the population of the upstate and of the Jewish population, which simply really means that most of the Jews in this area are not affiliating, are not really attracted to either congregation. And so in a sense, although in absolute terms they've stayed at the same strength, in relative terms I think it's really a lot weaker than it was years ago.
Sam, do you want to?
Yeah, I can say a little bit. I can't say that much because I don't live here now. But
Sam, you can also talk about Atlanta because that's another interesting comparison.
Okay. We belong to Congregation B'nai Torah in Atlanta. And when we came there, it was a traditional service, which is more like conservative, but it's conservative, but more of an Orthodox type service. And we recently got a rabbi who, after we joined the conservative movement, who started having women take part in the service. They do everything. They read the Torah. They, everything the men do. And we, weren't comfortable, we're not comfortable with that, but we, because that's not the way we were brought up, but we go ahead and accept it. The congregation, you know, has about 500 or 600 families, and we're talking about expanding right now. And the children got a good education. When our children were little, they went to Hebrew school 2 days a week, then on Sundays. And then, you know, the people started moving away, and the congregation dwindled. But now a new rabbi came in, and where our congregation is really the envy of Atlanta. And there are 12 shuls in Atlanta. They are about, I think, about 4 day schools, Hebrew day schools, which you would think would take away from the congregation, but they don't. We have a bar bat mitzvah almost every week, and it's a good experience. We enjoy living there. As far as here, you'd have to ask Barry or David about now. When I was growing up, we had about 20 families who were from Anderson, Elberton, Hartwell, Tocoa, in that area. And so, how many do we have? Still have about 20 families?
We have 30 families that belong to the synagogue. Actually, 28 now, 2 of them died.
Okay, 30 families now that belong to the synagogue. Okay, all right. So, but they don't have a Sunday school here like we had when I was growing up.
In Spartanburg, growing up in the 50s, 60s, into the 70s, it was by and large conservative, and Saturday mornings we always had a minyan, always were able to take the Torah out. And by the 70s, when attendance was waning, Rabbi Stauber decided to start counting women. We couldn't take the Torah out if we didn't do it, so it was kind of out of necessity. And ever since then, I think we've had gender equality in Spartanburg. We did vote in the mid-90s to go reform. And, after a couple years of a lot of internal struggle, the temple in Spartanburg voted to go reform, and it's reformed today. Of course, it serves everybody. We've got 122 families in Spartanburg, which, similar to what Fred was talking about in Greenville, at the height of textiles in the 70s, our membership was about 120. And here, 30 years later, that's what we've got, is about 120 families still.
Mm-hmm. But our synagogue membership actually grew when Butenit developed in 1960. Jonathan Logan Company decided to open a double knit mill in Spartanburg, and they sent Andrew Tesler, who was a Holocaust survivor and the son of a Holocaust survivor. And as I said, his father, Shandor, started integration in the mill at Kings Mountain. Well, when Andrew Tesler came to Spartanburg, he brought a lot of Jewish experts with him, and that did increase the Jewish membership quite a lot. So in the 70s, we had a pretty good membership, but it has not increased substantially. It's increased to some extent, but Butenit did bring a number of Jews to Spartanburg. And I thought, interestingly, many of them were not particularly religious in the New York area, and yet when they came to Spartanburg, the temple was very important to the Jewish population, and they became more involved in Judaism than they had been in the northern part of the country.
I think part culturally and religiously.
Yes.
Because it, from coming from New York and relocating in Spartanburg, it was every bit as much a cultural center as a religious center at that point, I think.
Mm-hmm. I heard for the first time today that there's now a Chabad in Greenville.
Mm-hmm.
So is this, well, just tell us a little bit about it. When did it come? Who's going?
Actually, Chabad came to Greenville about 5 years ago. And it's interesting, he's a young man named Adam Goodfriend, who has a really very remarkable background. He grew up in New York in Scarsdale in a totally secular Jewish family, had no Jewish education. The family never went to services, even on the holidays. He went to Horace Mann, which, if you know New York, is the most exclusive private school in New York City. And then during his junior year at Oberlin, went through a spiritual crisis. Just decided his life, you know, was not making much sense, and ended up in Chabad. That after studying, he told me all the religions in the world, Judaism and everything else, decided Chabad was for him. And I remember meeting him up for lunch when he first arrived in Greenville. He'd been there about a month. And I remember leaving with two thoughts in my mind. One is, he really seems like a nice guy. Maybe if he's lucky, he'll last here 6 months. and the second was, you know, this is Greenville. Who needs this? Well, he's been thriving since then. He's with a slowly growing group. I go to his services. We have one Saturday morning service every month. And in fact, we just had a Shabbos dinner at his house Friday night. They have 7 kids between the ages of 6 months and 10 years. And actually, I go there as much to play with their kids as any other reason. It's a wonderful atmosphere over there. And given the general direction that the established congregations are going in, that's really the only really traditional Judaism I think we have left in the Greenville area.
He is quite an interesting young man, Rabbi Goodfriend. He is 35 years old and has 7 children and is following all of the traditional ways. He doesn't shave. His beard is sort of unkempt, but he can easily be identified as an Orthodox Jew. He wears the typical garb of an Orthodox Jew, and he has the side curls and the sort of untrained mustache. But he's a delightful young man. He's very conversational, and I can see that he would attract a lot of people. He's very friendly, and I asked him about his name, Goodfriend. I thought, golly, that sure sounds a lot like a created name. And he said, no, his family was actually named Goodfriend, and the Goodfriend is merely a translation of the original.
Do you feel that the Chabad is taking members who would normally go to the other two synagogues, or is
a
this
few,
a
few? Yes.
No.
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 Well,
no.
In our community, there are some people who actually do go to the Chabad, but they still maintain their
membership.
Their dual membership. Mm-hmm. So, for the most part, he has not won over too many of our people, except the one family that I can think of.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have some Chabad centers in Atlanta, and they have taken people away from the former congregations. Not too many, but they take them away.
Mm-hmm. Maybe, Marsha, I'll start with you, just a little change of pitch here. How would you describe relations between Jews and Gentiles in your community? And I really do mean in every sort of way. Do Christians participate in synagogue services, for example, as members of the choir? Or have you had occasion to go to local churches with friends or acquaintances?
Well, the answer to all of this is yes. we are very friendly with the non-Jewish people in Spartanburg. We had our last Holocaust observance at a Baptist church, a Morningside Baptist, and the reverend there was very welcoming, and he spoke in behalf of all the Jews who perished, and he was very emotional. And our newspaper is extremely kind to the Jews. You might notice on my poster out in the lobby, they gave us a very nice write-up. I don't have all of it on there, but anytime there's a Jewish event, like our bake sale, they will give us a full page with the people involved and recipes. I mean, the community is so welcoming of Jews that I have never been aware of any anti-Semitism, although I understand that there has been some, but it's rare. And when my children went to school, they never came home complaining. It was always, they were always just like everyone else. And that compares to my bringing up in my schooling in Baltimore. When I was in the first grade, I was called a damn Jew. And I was assured that I would never go to heaven. So, there's quite a difference. I can say that Spartanburg has been extremely kind and friendly to the Jews there. And one thing that I find interesting right now, I've just published a book on Jewish life in Spartanburg, and I would say that maybe a third of the people who have bought books have been non-Jews. I was really surprised at that. I didn't know that there would be that much interest. But I had a second book signing in a downtown bookshop, and I would say at least half of the people at that particular event were non-Jews, with a sincere interest in Jewish life.
Gary, maybe you want to follow up, since your mother has taken your name in vain here. Do you agree that you have not experienced anti-Semitism in?
To a small extent, but not a terrible extent. You know, you heard things. You'd always have kids in high school talk to you about you're not going to go to heaven unless you believe like we believe, etc. But I've never viewed it as being extreme or excessive. We had a country club that didn't allow Jews for a number of years. We had a private dining club that until 1990 didn't allow Jews, but in 1990 it came around, and I think I was the second person in that. The first Jew was allowed in 1990. It was Henry Jacobs, who owned One Price Clothing. Everybody said Henry was worth about $50 million at the time. So for about a year, the talk was you could join the Piedmont Club if you were Jewish and worth about $50 million. they obviously went downhill the next year. But to my knowledge, there are no private country clubs or dining clubs in Spartanburg anymore that don't allow.
Actually, the same dining club now has bar mitzvah parties and they serve apples and mugs.
Sam, what's your experience of this? Have you experienced anti-Semitism here?
Yeah, I have. When I was in the Scouts, we went on a camping trip, and we were on a little island, and some other fellows came over and wanted to take some of our food. We wouldn't let them have it, so they went back across and started throwing rocks at us, hitting me and this other fellow. Our leader went and found this man to take us to the hospital, and so when he got us there, he told somebody if he'd known who I was, he would have left me out there. And he turned out to be a leader in the Ku Klux Klan. As I said, we had friends who called us dirty, well, friends, we played with them. They called us dirty Jews. But in school, I don't remember that much, anti-Semitism. In the Air Force, I didn't have any. But it was just those few times.
Mm-hmm. Well, growing up in Greenville, there was some anti-Semitism, but not really a great deal. I think part of the reason was to the fundamentalist Christian community, mostly Southern Baptists, who really were inspired by Bob Jones, it was much more important to hate Catholics than to hate Jews. And so the Catholics really absorbed a lot of this, there were so few Jews, we were sort of flying below the radar, so we didn't really see very much. There's probably even less anti-Semitism in Greenville today. and actually a lot of philo-Semitism, believe it or not. Probably the strongest supporters of Israel in Greenville today are the fundamentalist Christians. But of course, that cuts both ways. Probably one of the reasons for declining synagogue attendance and declining affiliation is the Jews have other things to do. Most of them have many more non-Jewish friends than they had 50 years ago, and so there are other priorities other than the Jewish community. So in a sense, it cuts both ways.
I'd like to say one more thing. Our son was in the Scouts, and he was sitting around a campfire with two other boys, a Baptist and a Hindu. And the Baptist said, Howie, you're not going to go to heaven because you don't believe in Jesus. And Howie said, well, I believe in God. And he says, that's not the same thing. The Hindu boy said, what's God? I should have said that at the Reader's Digest.
Did that really happen?
Yeah, it really happened.
That really happened. Well, this is really kind of a maybe bit of a follow-up of what Fred just said about, you know, I think Alan Dershowitz called it love to death in America. Are you aware of, for example, intermarriage proportions going up, or I mean, can you see in your own environment that the acceptance of Jews has caused a decline of Jewish life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it absolutely has. I mean, obviously there are other causes, but that you have to consider that one of them. I teach classes in Jewish history and philosophy at Furman at a learning and retirement thing, and I'm always surprised in every class there are at least two or three Jews who are, you know, have moved down here and have not affiliated at all, but they're just curious, you know, they just want to learn more about Judaism. But there's always at least two or three of the Gentiles there that they're in the class because their son or daughter is marrying a Jew, and they want to know more about the religion that their son's marrying into.
That kind of, to me, implies that it's possible the non-Jew would either convert or at least be amenable to raising the children.
Yes, sometimes they do. You know, and if you want to be an optimist about it, you can say maybe we're gaining people by these intermarriages. But if you're a realist, obviously it's a loss over the long run. And I think Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg, you know, who wrote a great book about Jews in America, once said, the real problem with the American Jewish community is they're going to run out of causes. And then what are they going to do? Most Jews, if they have any connection, are connected to Israel or to some fundraising type thing or whatever. There's really very little spiritual connecting to Judaism. And I think, you know, you can run so long on other things, but I think eventually, if there's no real connection to the religion, eventually it all evaporates.
Going back a little bit to social history and economic history, would you describe maybe again, starting with Mr. Drazen, how did the Great Depression and World War II affect your family and community?
Well, my grandmother raised 8 children in the Depression, and she sent all of them, 7 of them to college, 2 of them through medical school. I guess they just sold something people needed. As far as World War II, I had several uncles and several aunts who served in the military in World War II. That's really all I can tell you.
Well, this is kind of a second part of this question, but when did you or your family members become aware of what was happening in the Holocaust, and how did that, what effect did that have on your sense of identity as a Jew?
I remember one of the teachers in Sunday school, I saw the numbers tattooed on his arm and asked my mother what it was about, and she told me. And it really didn't affect me that much. I don't know why. I became more aware of it when I got married, because Carol lost most of her family in the Holocaust. And but As far as personally, when I was growing up, I didn't think that much about it. I don't know of anybody who did.
Has anyone on the panel had another experience in any of those regards?
I remember my father reading the Jewish Forward and just crying. He was so upset. But it seems that the only publicity that the Holocaust was getting in this country was from Jewish sources like the Forward. It was on the back pages, I understand, of the New York Times. So it didn't get a whole lot of publicity in this country. Actually, they were trying to suppress it, suppress any publicity about it.
Anything else?
But let me add a little bit to that. When the refugee ship, the St. Louis, tried to dock in New York Harbor, it was sent away because Roosevelt had advisors who were extremely anti-Semitic. And actually, anti-Semitism was rife in those years, especially in Baltimore. In the 1920s and 30s, it was commonplace to hear unkind remarks about Jews. And the ship with Jewish refugees who tried to land in this country was turned away, and they tried also to dock in Havana, and they were again turned away, and they had to go back to Europe. And of course, they were likely to have been killed in Europe when they returned.
And yet, I've heard the Marcia talk about Sandor Tesler, Fred talk about Max Heller and their impact on their communities. I mean, at some point, people must have had, just from their own personal communication with these refugees and these survivors, they must have had kind of an awakening. And it's actually a big point right now of historical interest among professional American Jewish historians. When did local American communities kind of become aware and start memorializing the destruction of European Jewry?
I think with the influx of Holocaust survivors, we did become more aware of what was going on and how Jews were so disregarded during the 30s and 40s in Europe, and even in this country, it was that way at that time. We have come a long way since then. In fact, Alan Dershowitz says in his book about Jewish survival that Jews have never had it as good as they have now, and I think we're living examples of that. We don't have big issues about anti-Semitism in any of our communities. Of course, it exists. There's small pockets of it. But currently, we are very far away from that. Perhaps the Holocaust survivors have nailed that down so that we are more aware of what they suffered.
I want to ask one more historical question and then ask the audience to either pitch questions to our panelists or, if you're interested, share your own experience. I know a lot of people here are from the upstate. My last question is, and this is a big one, so maybe we'll get a couple people to respond. What were race relations like in your community before, during, and after the civil rights movement of the 60s? And more personally, what was your reaction to school desegregation?
The Jewish community here has always gotten along well with the African American community. I remember my parents hired a young black girl to work in the office once, and of course, they had to let her go because the customers stopped coming in. But after that, as far as education, it didn't bother me. with blacks going to school with whites.
Sammy, tell a story about Dad running for office in 1955.
About what?
Remember when Dad ran for office in 1955 or 56 at the school board? Remember?
Barry, you can tell.
No, you can tell.
You can tell it. You want to come use pick the mics up?
No.
Yeah.
You can hear me. I think it was
recording.
Well, they can't record it.
They can't hear you from out down there.
It was 1955 or 56, and you know, our dad moved back to Boston. He was actually a transplant Yankee, and he saw segregation, integration coming. So he ran for the school board on the platform that they should start integration in the first grade, so that by the time integration came, that we would already be integrated and there wouldn't be any problems. And I think that he got about, I think he got 5 votes.
Yeah.
That was about 1995.
A resounding defeat.
Jews were more progressive than others in the 50s and 60s. Of course, there wasn't any integration in upstate South Carolina until about 66, 67 at the earliest. Brown v. School Board of Education was 54 and was just ignored in South Carolina until the Civil Rights Acts of the mid-60s. But once it came to be, I think Jews were at least more progressive than other folks.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody specifically remember the Freedom Riding buses in Rockville, which preceded Greensboro, North Carolina?
Mm-hmm. What year was that, Dave?
When was Greensboro? 62 or something?
62.
So it would have been just before that. Mm-hmm.
62, I was 12 years old.
Well, let me just open it up to the audience for either questions or anecdotes. The lady in pink.
Lady in pink.
My name is Joyce Klein, and I arrived as a Yankee in Clemson, South Carolina in 1981. I had a question, and a couple of comments. The whole issue of anti-Semitism, unfortunately, in the United States today, anti-Semitism is very ripe and alive on college campuses. We have escaped most of that so far at Clemson, but we are in touch with people from a lot of other college campuses, and it is absolutely awful because the anti-Israel movement has turned into anti-Jewish movement. And a lot of people really have their head in the dark of how bad it really is. I've seen videotapes of some of the things that were happening on college campuses. And as another thing on anti-Semitism, I was wondering, Fred, if you would comment about Max Heller's run for Congress against Carol Campbell.
Now, Max had been a very successful two-term mayor in Greenville, and then I believe it was during the 70s, I wasn't living here then, he ran for Congress against Carol Campbell.
It was a 78, yeah. And actually appeared to be doing fairly well. Of course, the problem was that for mayor, you just need the Greenville city limit vote, which is really a very small area and very black also. Once you run for Congress, then you have all that rural area in between Greenville and Spartanburg. So it was a different electorate to begin with. But also, one of the things that supposedly did make a difference is that a third candidate came into the race. And he was a self-professed Christian who brought the religion issue up, actually saying it in his campaign speeches, do you want a man representing you in Washington who doesn't have any kind of relationship to Jesus, that kind of thing. And Max lost the election, whether that or whether for other reason, we don't know, but he believed it played a role. Later on, very, very, very many years later, Max got a call from Lee Atwater. And Lee Atwater was the Republican strategist who dreamed up this whole thing. Max didn't know it at the time. This was a typical dirty trick of his to influence the election. And at this point, Atwater was dying of a brain tumor. And he actually wanted to sort of atone for a lot of what he'd done by calling up the people. He had treated that way and apologizing. And he actually called up Max, apologized to him, and told him what had happened in that election.
And let me add a couple of things to that. That election was 1978, and it was one of Lee Atwater's first great successes, I guess you could call it. At the time, my dad was Democratic Party chair in Spartanburg, and I remember well we were getting phone calls constantly of the push polling, the telephone polling. This was the early days of push polling. It was done brilliantly, but very sinister. Later, a pollster for Carroll Campbell came out and he said that he conducted a poll, and the poll initially was a series of questions and then was narrowed down to three questions. One of the three questions was, could you vote for a person for U.S. Congress who was foreign born? And in the 4th District, which at the time was Greenville and Spartanburg, overwhelmingly people said they could. Next question was, could you vote for someone for U.S. Congress who is Jewish? And again, a pretty large percentage said they could. Third question was, could you vote for someone for U.S. Congress who is Jewish and who does not believe in our Lord Jesus Christ? Overwhelmingly, the answer to the question number three was negative. The next day on the stand at the stump meetings, the third party candidate, who was a record driver named Sprouse, stood up and said, Max Heller is a Jew who does not believe in our Lord Jesus Christ. And that was the exact line used for the rest of the campaign. And then they began intense telephone push polling, where that was the line of the discussion from apparently thousands and thousands of phone calls. Max only lost that race by 1%.
Yeah.
I'm not going to go back to something. I was listening to the experiences of people in this community and whether there was anti-Semitism or not. And in all honesty, I was really afraid when I moved down here. My husband was joining the faculty at Clemson, and a lot of my friends said, do you know you're going to the Bible Belt? They're going to burn a cross on your lawn and all this kind of stuff. I mean, they really were driving me crazy. And I came here, and my husband and I were both very active in the interfaith community. He was the volunteer faculty advisor for Jewish students. And what really amazed me and very heartwarming is we personally never experienced any anti-Semitism here. And if anything, we had the interesting experience of having it reinforced, you are the people of the book, and therefore we have to respect you. And I was invited to go out and teach about Judaism in many of the churches many times. And I've been president of the interfaith group. And so I had a different experience than, you know, some other people, but I came here with great trepidation, really, really. I mean, you know, 81 wasn't that terribly long after the school integrated, and it had, and they not only were not a military college, they now had blacks and women, you know, so, you know, they're getting used to that. And I had quite to the contrary of stories I've heard from people in other communities, whether it be in the upstate or not. But I can tell you that in the upstate, Greenville is by far the most fundamentalist, conservative. And it's turning around a little that when we did the Jewish festival in Greenville last year and the year before, it was amazing to see how many non-Jewish people came by who were really hungry to learn more and more about Judaism. And Richard and I staffed the room with Jewish religious objects that different members of the congregation had loaned. And people came in, oh, I just bought a kippah at a talis last week. Or, you know, what is that? We explained the ketubah, and I want that because I'm getting married. And I mean, there is the segment of the Christian population now who are really into Judaism. And we had a family from Greenville over to our home for Shabbat dinner last week, and they are Presbyterian and homeschooling their children, and they are teaching their children a lot about Judaism, about Shabbat, about holidays, and their children had made their own little Shabbat dinner, and so I made the suggestion to this family. The guy is a former student of my husband's. He's now president of one of the banks in Greenville, and I said, why don't they come to our house for Shabbat dinner? And honest, these kids know more about Judaism than some of the Jewish kids I know. And so I, you know, because of this connection with Israel, it produced a lot of negatives in some area, but it's amazing the positives of the Christians wanting to learn more about Judaism, whether the motive is when all the Jews are in Israel, then they will convert, whatever it is. I don't care about what that is, but right now, it's our main support for Israel, because a lot of the Jews are not supporting Israel. And so I see a whole turn happening.
I want to turn the mic over to Elaine, because you had your hand up before. Elaine.
Well, this was just going back to the segregation.
Yeah.
I think my guilty feeling about it, I came from the north, so obviously I thought it was bad from the minute I came to South Carolina. But I happened to be teaching when they integrated the schools. And they integrated, do you remember, with token integration? I had the one little black girl in my class. They put her in my class because I was a Yankee and they knew it wouldn't bother me at all. And there was one black teacher, and she was my buddy teacher. And now that I look back on it, I think that was just horrible. Can you imagine that one child? I don't know how they ever selected or how her parents talked her into it. But that's the way it was in the South Carolina schools for that first year. And then the next year, Maloney, they closed one of the schools and everybody went together. But that, I mean, I just always think that I didn't realize at the time how bad that really was.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll start here and then come forward.
I'm Daniel Grayson. My dad's Barry. Sam Mobble. I want to give you a perspective. Maybe everybody wants a perspective, a different perspective. I mean, I grew up here in Anderson. I went to the public schools in Anderson, but in a different generation than they did. And, you know, I was in high school in the 80s. I graduated in 1990, so I was in high school in the late 80s and middle school in the 80s. And I can tell you that I got all the same things that my Uncle Sam talks about, you know. It just wasn't out there publicly, but if somebody found out you were Jewish, you were more different than anybody else. I mean, I was the only Jewish kid in my high school. Jeff Green, my good friend, his father just passed away, was the only Jewish kid in the other high school. So there was two of us, and my parents and his parents were very good friends, obviously. And so there were only two of us. And I think that the reason you didn't hear much about anti-Semitism is because nobody knew there was any Jews in their school, okay? But if they found out, there was anti-Semitism. Believe me, overt anti-Semitism. It wasn't even, I mean, you're not going to heaven, you're gonna burn in hell. I heard it all as a kid. And in fact, speaking of race relations, if the black kids found out you were Jewish, you were more of a minority than they were. So it was a problem. Okay. Now, I have no overt racism. I mean, personally, I have no problem with any of the races. I get along with everybody. But I'm telling you, growing up a kid here, it was because it was such a minority. And because so many people don't know people that are Jewish or don't know they know people that are Jewish. Because we don't walk around wearing yarmulkes anymore or payas or, you know, that's not the, you know, you just fit in. We fit in. We dress like everybody else. The only thing we do different is we pray differently, pretty much. But we are in small towns in rural South Carolina. I think we're so integrated in the way that we participate in our communities in general that it just goes unnoticed. There's no voice there. But if you made a stink, if you raised the issue, just like in the election in 78, would it be used against you? Would it be an issue still? I believe it would. I mean, my Uncle David's been serving on the school board. And, you know, they've elected him to the school board several times. But I really wonder if you polled the people that voted for him, how many people knew that he was Jewish. I guarantee you the majority of people who elected him don't have a clue what religion we are. I mean, my senior partner in my law firm is Jewish. So I have two Jewish lawyers in town practice together in the same law firm. And my other partner, his brother-in-law, converted to Judaism, married a girl, and they live in Maine. So you almost have three Jewish lawyers in the law firm, basically. But, you know, but beyond that, there aren't any in this town. There are 30 families that come here, not from Anderson, by the way. When there are 30 families in this community, they're not all from Anderson. They're from Clemson. They're from other areas. They're not just from the Anderson area. So the Anderson community of Jews, people that live in Anderson, is real, real small. And so what we've done is we've escaped the things that you're asking about because it's hidden. Nobody knows. I just want to make that point.
Although, that is why we never close our doors here for anybody to come to our services. We are always inviting any of the community in the whole city of Anderson or wherever to come and observe here anytime. And we often, through the year, will get anywhere from 6 to 15 students from Anderson University or from Clemson or taking a comparative religion class, and they'll come here and see that we're not these strange people that, you know, maybe they don't know exist. So,
Ellen, do you cover your horns?
I just want to say one thing. It's a very interesting idea that the reason that there's appears to be no overt anti-Semitism is this invisibility. Because one of the things that Alyssa and I have heard, I don't remember if it was in an oral history or some from some other source, was that for many years, maybe more than a decade, B'nai Israel did not put a sign out front.
Yeah, we did.
Okay, so would one of you talk to that? Because to me, that is the epitome of what your son is describing of being basically...
Well, no, it's really a little different, because back in the 1940s and 1950s, remember how Gary said everybody changed professions. Most of the Jews were in local businesses. So we didn't have a name out here because we were afraid that it would cause more anti-Semitism. If we didn't have, we didn't put a name on the synagogue until, 15 years ago, I think. And there was just no name at all.
But I think it's been there longer than that.
It's been there at least 25
years.
Yeah, at least 25.
It's on
the building when we came.
Well, Ellen's dad made that sign.
I want to ask a couple more people to take their turn.
I guess since I first raised my hand, the topic's changed about 12 times.
That's okay. And, we can go back to the first.
All right. Well, I was going to say real quickly, we had devotionals over the loudspeaker when I was at Spartan High, and all through high school, all through elementary school, even though we weren't supposed to have prayers in school because they were outlawed in 1962. And we had this coach, and we had assemblies, and everybody would have to go to the assembly, whether we wanted to or not. And we had about 6 Jews out of 2,000 kids at Spartan High. We had 2,000 kids because what they decided to do was close down Carver High and combine it with Spartan High. So it was a huge school by then. And the coach was saying, well, if I didn't have Jesus Christ with me, I couldn't go out that door. I couldn't, you know, I couldn't be here at school. I couldn't wake up in the morning. And so, but this was senior year, so by then we just were just fed up with it. And I guess we felt like, well, now we can say anything we want because we've already been accepted to college, and who cares what they think. And we told them, there were 6 of us in the whole school, we didn't want to have to be subject to that because it was against the law. And so finally they said, okay, fine, you can just stay in the room during assembly. But what I was going to say quickly a minute ago is there's a little anecdotal story. In 1948, before we were born, my dad was very popular in the State House, and Strom Thurmond asked him to come to his office. He wanted to ask him a question. He said, Matthew, I want you to make 3 speeches in Spartanburg County in my behalf. He was running on the state's rights ticket, Dixiecrats, which meant basically segregation now, segregation forever. And my dad said, my dad was popular, and Daddy said in 1948, $1,000 was a lot of money. But Daddy said to Strom Thurmond, he said, I'm a Democrat, and he said, I hope to hell I never need money that bad. Good day, sir.
just for the folks who don't know who you want to say who you are?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Brene Polakoff, and there's common against what the common wisdom is. We're not all lawyers.
In the family. Some of you are writers.
Well, my sister is a wonderful writer and teaches at Goucher College and in Baltimore. And I'm a musician, a singer, songwriter, and perform, and have been living in Atlanta for a very long time. So,
yeah. And I have one other thing to say. Okay. That is that my brother and I, Barry, anyway, always have believed, when you're talking about good friend and the chabad about taking away from other congregations, we've always felt like our philosophy is not get more a bigger piece of the same pie, but make the pie bigger. And I think if good friend is here getting people that are not affiliated with other congregations, I think it's great, because more people are out there studying their faith, you know, because I don't think he's taking away from us at all. I think he's actually adding by helping other people who don't go to synagogue and don't go to temple and whatnot. You know, I think he's doing a great thing for her. You know, that's
I was the faculty advisor, volunteer faculty advisor for the Clemson Hill Elm between 1981 and 1997. The Clemson Hill Elm was started in 1938 by a Presbyterian minister. The reason I had to do research, because we had the centennial of Clemson University in 1989, and the first Jewish person graduated from Clemson in 1901. I mean, I can go on to different things. But one thing that Dr. Levitt might mention is the fact the number of Jews who were involved in fighting during World War II. I think of Herb Abrams, I think of Jack Blum, and you probably can go on and so on.
General, would you say your name, Richard?
Richard Klein.
Klein,
K-L-E-I-N.
E-I-N, okay. I think that was a question, Rick.
Oh, okay. Do I need that? Okay. Yeah, actually, there were quite a few Jews involved in World War II. There's a in Beth Israel, the lobby, they have a big frame thing with all the pictures of the guys in their uniform then. Probably one of the most interesting ones, I don't know how many of you know Max Corellis, who used to live in Fountain Inn and moved to Greenville. Max is celebrating his 100th birthday next week. And he was an Army captain in the Pacific in World War II. And I think he accepted the surrender of an entire Japanese company at one point. It's a marvelous story. But yeah, that was a generation where everybody served, and almost everybody in that age group in our congregation did serve.
Has anyone recorded an oral history of
them? Unfortunately, no. Somebody should.
Quickly.
Yeah.
Quickly.
With that, do we?
Let me make one comment about this congregation. Yes. Whether you're a member or not a member, you're welcome on the holidays, you're welcome at any time. This is the most welcoming group that meet on Friday night, all the holidays. They have wonderful lay leadership constantly, and I think they have to be really, Ellen, the Graysons have been the mainstay of the congregation. And they have welcomed anyone. They don't ask for donations. They don't ask for dues. If you want to join, they welcome you.
Well, that a big round of applause for our panel.